evening, good morning, good afternoon. Jason and Steve and Robinson Jeffers, we're here to welcome you back to the back porch. Jeffers today has a poem for us called "But I Am Growing Old and Indolent."
Why did he write a poem about me?
Oh, man. You stole my thunder. Dude, I was going to ask you, like, Steve, you're uniquely suited to talk about this poem. Okay. Well, get ready,
Experience
Steve.
Brings perceptivity.
This is fantastic. Here we go. This is a poem about Steve by Robinson Jeffers. I have been warned. It is more than 30 years since I wrote, thinking of the narrative poems I made, which always ended in blood and pain, though beautiful enough, my pain, my blood. They were my creatures. I understood and wrote to myself, make sacrifices once a year to magic horror away from the house. For that hangs imminent over all men and all houses. This little house here you have built over the ocean with your own hands beside the standing sea boulders. So I listened to my demon warning me that evil would come if my work ceased, if I did not make sacrifice of storied and imagined lives, Tamar and Cowder and Thurso's wife, imagined victims, be our redeemers. At that time, I was sure of my fates and felt my poems guarding the house, well-made watchdogs ready to bite. But time sucks out the juice. A man grows old and indolent.
Bah. Well, I haven't heard that before.
Okay.
I don't know why the part there, this little house here you have built over the ocean with your own hands beside the standing sea boulders, it's in quotes. Yeah. Is that from some other poem of his, or am I?
I don't know. Okay, so I don't know the answer to that question. I think that what he's after here is he's saying he put it in quotes because he wrote this like in his journal way back when to his future self.
Gotcha. So right? Yeah, I love the capture of with age and time comes a sort of a leveling out of one's expectations and dreams. You start to you know, reality starts to mix with the impatience of youth, and you realize, okay, it's probably not going to be as good as I had thought it would be, but as long as I keep writing these poems, there's hope. But I get tired.
Right. Time sucks out the juice.
One of my friends from the past, who's a writer, recently said on Facebook that she's spending less time writing these days. She's not sure why. She still has all kinds of ideas. But when she sits down at the keyboard, as she put it, her fingers get fat. She just doesn't. She's a grammarian. So as she starts, in the past, she could write and then come back and fix it. And now she gets caught up in the mistakes, right? Her finger hits one letter instead of another, and she's got to stop and fix it, and then the flow of thought slows down. And she says, I wasn't this way when I was young. I could just hammer it out and then go back and fix it. Now I've got to fix every little mistake as I go along. So I think there is something to that. And, of course, the little listeners wait impatiently for me to get old enough to stop making these podcasts. So as long as we keep recording them, I'm not that indolent, apparently.
That's right. Yeah, our podcast will guard the house.
Yes, time will slowly suck out the juice. That's an amazing line there. I like that.
Yeah, it's pretty fantastic. Okay, Steve, so today we're talking about fiction, right? Like why we should teach it in our classrooms, what place it has in this busy, technologically advanced, factual world of ours. why fiction is worth our time. And I thought that it would be maybe not appropriate, but I thought it would be as good an introduction as any to start with a confession. I don't think you know this about me, that although I have read Wendell Berry's poems and essays extensively, I have never read a word of his fiction.
Well, I mean, there was this sense of you being uneducated. I just now have.
I always knew you were an ingrate, Jason, but now I know why.
The proof, sir. I have the proof. At your own tongue, you have made it clear. Well, so that's a great place to start. Let me start by this. I have a lot of reasons. I could talk all day about why stories, quote unquote, fiction, which the term bugs me a little bit.
Thank you. Good. We'll start there later.
Okay. But the use of stories in the classroom is a wonderful, wonderful thing for a number of reasons. But you brought up Wendell Berry, so it's your fault.
Absolutely.
If our listeners are not familiar with Wendell Berry, he is an American treasure. He's now in his 80s. He lives next door to where he grew up. He in his youth went to the University of Kentucky. And then spent some time out in Berkeley studying with
Stenger. It's Stanford, isn't it?
Stegner, and who's kind of his mentor, another great novelist. And if you haven't read Stegner's Angle of Repose, you've got to. It's just a necessary thing.
We'll have a link to that because I haven't read it either, but I want to now that you say that.
All right, and then he went in the 60s. You got to think this through in what's going on in our nation. Having sort of graduated, gotten his master's degree, he heads to Greenwich Village right in the 60s, and he's in that whole thing. But the heart called him home, and he wound up purchasing a plot of land next to his father's farm and has been a farmer ever since and has written extensively, which is how most people know him. He's not the world's most famous farmer. He's a quite famous author. And he has written in three absolutely connected but differing tracks. He has a long line of writing essays, often published in periodicals, but they're tremendously astute and worthy of close reading, multiple readings.
Absolutely.
An armchair philosopher, to be sure. Mm-hmm. With that as well, he has had the lifelong writing habit of writing at least one poem every Sunday afternoon. So over the years, he has produced quite a large collection of poetry that follows his philosophical notion, which people call him the father of slow food. He has an environmentalist streak in him. He's upset that his home state of Kentucky has been so ravaged by strip mining and whatnot. He's concerned about the agricultural business. And I know I'm turning this into an episode on Wendell Berry, but that I have friends who love his essays and have never touched anything else he's written. I have a few friends who mainly know him as a poet. They've run across The Mad Farmer or some other famous poem of his, and that's how they know him. I came into him through his stories and still believe that if my one friend who's a decade or so older than me says, I don't have time for his stories. I got to go straight to the essays. I'm too old to mess with having to work through his stories and figure out what he's trying to say. I just want it plain and simple. Give it to me. Now, plain and simple is in quotations when you're talking about his essays, but I got to go right to, I want it just an intravenous injection of Wendell Berry. And my reason for having stories in the classroom is similar, I think, to why Wendell Berry has spent so much of his time writing up a large collection of fiction all centered around this place, this fictional place, Port William, Kentucky.
Yeah,
Port William. And it embodies the things that he's trying to preach in his essays. You see the kind of people that he thinks we ought to be, as opposed to just, you know, premise upon premise to the following conclusion. You come to live in a community that to him defines what the best of agrarian society embodies. And right. He's part and parcel with the old Southern agrarians. Richard Weaver, I would have loved to, I don't know if it ever happened, but if he and Flannery O'Connor had ever gotten together, there isn't a conversation I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall for.
Oh, yeah.
But this love of his place, this love of old rural America, I don't know how else to put it. He's not in love with the past. He just sees something that's been lost. And he's saying, what would it take? We have to recover some of the love of land, or our future looks bleak. So the first and main reason I love to have stories in my classroom is because they embody ideas, as opposed to just telling students who they ought to be. I'm able to show them both positive and negative examples, and there's an incredible power. It's just as important that there's a really good bad guy in the story as it is that there's a hero.
Yeah.
The antagonist has to be equal to the protagonist, or it's a terrible story.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And okay. So let's hammer that out a little bit, because I think that's huge. Barry, you're saying, does it well. I believe you. And I'll find out soon, because, I was recently at a book sale, and they had A Place on Earth and Jaber Crow. They were each $1, so I got them both. And we'll see. I don't know. Which one should I start with?
A Place on Earth will get you into the scenery better. Jaber Crow is probably his
best
novel.
That's kind of his thing, right? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Yeah. So I might just start there. But in any event, yeah, I think that what you were saying about the way that fiction embodies, I don't know, that rings true for me. And I think that's in contradiction to your buddy who, you know, you mentioned earlier, right? This sort of just give it to me straight, right? Cut the crap.
Yeah.
I don't have time. I don't have, like, what is the truth after you take off all the fanciful language and the intricate storylines? Just give me the conclusion. That's not great, right? I mean, that's the sort of thing that is really kind of not human, I would say. At least not all that a human can be. When we look at the great works of the past, recently in history, we've decided to categorize these works as fiction, when before, you know, previous humans weren't troubled by making that distinction. Sort of, did this really happen, or did somebody make it up?
Right. Well, so we've gone so far, in my opinion, as to almost put those at odds, right?
Right.
I teach at a school, and so there is a history department, and there is an English department, which for me, while I in high school do still teach some grammar, the heart and soul of my English class is the literature program, what we're reading, the books that we're interacting with. And, you know, I've had good conversations with the history department that we're basically teaching the same thing. We're teaching wisdom and virtue.
Yeah.
It's the humanities. And And so you get to teach stories that we're pretty confident actually happened and how they happened. But it's still the story, right?
Right.
Tarawa occurred in World War II. Marines went through that awful several days of just being mowed down by the dozens. And it really happened. And there's a power to that. When they talk, you know, one of the history teachers at my school, his father was one of those Marines.
Wow.
So when he tells the story, he's telling it very passionately. My father was there, right?
Wow.
Which puts a flavor to the story that's intense. You know, it moves the listener. Well, you can argue all you want about whether there ever was a guy named Odysseus or whether or not there could even possibly be a Cyclops. But it is still a story that moves men and women sometimes.
Yeah. Why don't you just go ahead and say, and women, and then keep going.
Well, so a side note on Homer, the guys really get into Iliad. The girls like Odyssey better. So many women have liked the Cyclops and Odysseus, probably Penelope more. But so you're reading this story, and the fact that it isn't – I even hesitate to say it isn't historical. The fact that we don't have evidence, artifacts to prove that a guy named Odysseus actually did this doesn't get in the way – of it being a really good story that still moves us towards wisdom, moves us towards virtue.
Good.
Makes us better people.
Right. So that's a big thing, right? Is the movement, the movement of the soul, be it historical or, literature, right? History or literature, it's a movement of the soul. I think that is a really important point because after the Enlightenment happens, and we get this idea of, we start getting very specific about fiction or nonfiction.
Right.
What we've done is, said, okay, movement of the soul, forget about the soul. The soul doesn't even exist. Now, what words do are they either inform about something that is real, factual, that's not something that happened, or they're entertainment, right?
Right.
They're just something, they're fanciful, but they're not factual. And the movement of the soul is lost in that. And I think that's a great disservice to us. One of the many disservices that the Enlightenment performed for us is that it changed the game, right? It changed the dichotomy from, does this move the soul or not? And when we say move it, I guess we could say it can also move the soul away from goodness and virtue,
certainly
away from wisdom and truth and beauty, and that would then be bad. Or does it? So does it move the soul toward the good, or does it not? That dichotomy was replaced with, does this inform me, my mind, or not? Right? Can I use this or not?
Right. So, back when we believed stories really had this power, we were, if you remember, Plato wanted to ban certain kinds of reading from the Republic, right? You can't, can't read.
Right.
The taste, I think the moral imagination of a child is going to be damaged if they read bad literature. They're not going to form the proper loves that they should have, right? So 1930s, Frank Baum drops sorry for the pun, a bombshell on American and Western literature.
That was pretty good. I'll allow it. I like that.
All right. in the form of Wizard of Oz, where we have, for the first time in Western civilization, a good witch. And it was very controversial. You can't this is like a fairy tale, right? The whisk away in a tornado and goes to this sort of fairy land of the Land of Oz and meets up with a good witch battling bad witches. There's still bad witches in the story, but a good witch. And there was great concern that this would confuse little minds. Wait a minute. My definition of witch doesn't include the notion of good.
Right.
I think you're right. The Enlightenment has made it possible for us to have this ambiguity about morals and stories.
So Baum is in perfect alignment with the Enlightenment there, right? Because there's no such thing as a witch. So who cares if a witch is good or bad in my story? It doesn't matter. I'm just telling you something. So it's either entertaining or not. So who cares?
Right.
Because like there are no rules. I can make it be whatever I want.
And kids will be entertained by it and it's just not going to matter. Right.
Exactly.
But it does. And I don't have a problem.
It does.
I don't have as big a problem with, say, teenagers who want to go watch a movie in which, an ogre and a donkey are walking around, having a chat,
sure,
cracking jokes and letting off farts and whatnot. But the problem is that the ogre is a sympathetic character. And in our Western literature, we have a place for ogre. It's a monster that eats people. It's not good. And so now we have this sort of anti-hero, valueless. Because, like you said, ogres don't really exist, so we can make them whatever we want them to be. Mm-hmm. And types do exist, right?
Right.
And so when we mess with a long established type, we run the risk of confusing children, little ones, the ones that need they're trying to figure out how I should behave. I want to be like David, not like Goliath. And, you know, I don't know if anybody has, but somebody come along and turn, well, Goliath is basically a good guy, is just in the wrong place, the wrong time. You know, no, emphatically, no. The reason, and I purposely chose a biblical story because, hey, God in communicating his truth to us embodied it in stories throughout the Old and New Testament, right? And we stand up when the life of our Lord is read in the gospel because that's the most vibrant story we have. We're to follow him.
Go ahead.
It's not just principial, it's personal, it's embodied. The truth is him. And when he does this or says that, or we read, and then somebody comes along and goes, well, it's all mythology anyway, so it doesn't matter. You know, whoa.
Yeah, calm down there.
Stop just a moment and let's think about what you're – because if it isn't real, you know, this was C.S. Lewis's problem, is he viewed Christianity as just another mythology. And Tolkien is walking in the garden with him one evening and says, what if it's not only a myth, but it's a true myth? What if it did actually happen, but also provides for us what mythological stories provide, an explanation for everything? Jesus actually walked this earth as God. It's written, you know, Poseidon never has, but Christ has. And that makes that story where history and quote unquote fiction cross and it's real is a big deal there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. So you kind of threw out a lot there that I was thinking about, that I wanted to pick up on. And I think the first thing is this notion of David and Goliath, right? Okay, that's a biblical story. And so there may be some who would say, yeah, but Steve, okay, that story happened, right? Like, that's true. So that story happened. So God gave us history there, right? Okay, cool. But then I think it's a pretty easy move from there to the parables.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. When Jesus told us a lot of stories, and I'm not going to say those stories really did or really did not happen.
Yeah.
I think if you're asking the question, you know, the parable of the mustard seed, did that really happen? I think that's the wrong question to ask of that story.
What does it matter?
Right. Exactly. There are more important things going on there. Like, that's, Jesus didn't tell the story because it happened. Jesus told the story for other more important, more soul moving reasons.
Right. Mustard seeds are huge. Right. They're the size of your head. Or not.
Or not. Right. Yeah. So, no, I think that's really good. So that God has given us stories that in some way are a representation. I don't even know if I want to use the word representation. That in some way he embodies, right? That Christ has embodied these truths. And I think even here for fiction lovers like us, the temptation is to get very formulaic, right? To pin a moral on every story to give ourselves license for teaching it, right? So we read a story and we say, oh yeah, you know, the moral of this story is love your neighbor. And then that gives us license for teaching it.
Yeah.
That may not be a bad move.
No,
I think
it is a bad move.
It's the wrong thing. Yeah. Okay, good. I'm glad you do.
So,
because it's not the thing, right? That's not what the story's after. And to you effectively neuter the story when you do that, because if the story, if the fictional story could be reduced to the moral that you have reduced it to,
then it is a waste of time.
Then there's no reason. Yeah. There's no reason to tell the story. Just give me the moral and
I'll
move on.
Exactly. And I think that you mentioned earlier, the transcendentals, I think that they are best wrapped up in a story, right? They're true, and the good and the beautiful all coalesce into one beautiful, true, and good thing in a story. If it's a good story, right? Mm-hmm. If it's a great story.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And beauty's purpose is to move us towards the true and the good. And so when art, the storytelling art, is done well, we forget that it's a story because we're in the story. And so when I'm trying to there's really several jobs I have as an English teacher, most of which are not preparing the perfect lesson. My preparation of the lesson is choosing the right literature, mm-hmm. and preparing students then to enter into that literature. I don't have any nervousness about a Shakespearean play. Is it any good?
Okay.
Is it a story worth reading? My nervousness is, mm-hmm. what is it going to take for me to help my students get past all the obstacles and be in Macbeth, so that when Malcolm is there in the church contemplating this offer to go back and take over the kingdom because Scotland's under the rule of an absolute tyrant and we've got to get rid of Macbeth, and he thinks through, I'm just like him. If given power...
Yeah.
I'm going to rape and pillage and cheat and murder and do everything he's done. I'm human.
Mm-hmm.
And the heart that's there, that's been led to this moment, has seen the downfall of Macbeth has watched Lady Macbeth go crazy, has interacted with the story. If they're there, if they're in the story, if they're standing there in that church, listening to these gentlemen go back and forth, their heart sings with that, right? It says, I wouldn't want it either, which is totally different than if they were just told, look, if somebody ever offers you the kingship, don't take it because, you know, you could be a bad person too.
Right. Or even you are a bad person too.
Right. They're not.
Right.
Only if you've seen.
It's not.
Only if you've seen a great hero like Macbeth, heroic in the war, be given just these little prophecies that then warp his mind, and it's just kaboom, 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 kaboom. How much lower can this guy go? You know, he's saying that at the end of the play. It's time for me to die. I can't get any words. I'm so weary with my sin. There's a lot to get a student into Shakespeare and to get past the high use of language. I don't want to say get past it, but get into it, right? So my job in the classroom is not to strip it all down to, so what we learn from Macbeth is, or even, can you name me all the players and what they do in the play? The nugget, the core, the seed is the story. And I don't just mean the plot. I mean, what's going on? And the amazing thing to me is that when I work hard to get them to that, all the other planning takes care of itself, right? They just start asking questions, and they just start digging in. They start disagreeing with the author, and they start pushing back, and they start exploring their own heart based on the heart of the hero. And all of a sudden, you've got something that doesn't even necessarily feel like class. We're in this thing, and that's what I just love teaching stories, because the one problem with teaching stories in a school is that stinking bell, because it's going to break us in the middle of a thought, and it's so tough to get them back the next day and go, now, remember we were talking, it's almost worthless. But we had that half thought before that stupid bell interrupted us.
Right. Well, and so, okay, that's right. I think what you're driving at with the Shakespeare example there, with that story, is to say that it's irreducible. That fiction, let's see. That good fiction is irreducible to something else. So if you have a fiction story, right, that you could... that you could reduce to a moral and give it to me, then I think you should just give me the moral. Like, don't tell me the story just cause. But the best stuff is not reducible. You can't but be affected by it. That's what it's doing, right? And you can't be affected by anything else the same way. Have you, Steve, have you read Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov? Yep. Okay. Do you remember the parable of the woman who gave a beggar an onion?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's my example of sort of something that's irreducible. And here, I pulled it up. Let me read it. It's not that long. Because I think it gets at, this is a perfect example for me of something that you can't reduce to something else. You can't just put a moral on it. Okay, so here we go. Once upon a time, there was a woman, and she was wicked as wicked could be, and she died. And not one good deed was left behind her. The devils took her and threw her into the lake of fire, and her guardian angel stood thinking, what good deed of hers can I remember to tell God? Then he remembered and said to God, once she pulled up an onion and gave it to a beggar woman. And God answered, take now that same onion, hold it out to her in the lake. Let her take hold of it and pull. And if you pull her out of the lake, she can go to paradise. The angel ran to the woman and held out the onion to her. Here, woman, he said, take hold of it and I'll pull. And he began pulling carefully and had almost pulled her all of the way out when other sinners in the lake saw her being pulled out and all began holding on to her so as to be pulled out with her. But the woman was wicked as wicked could be, and she began to kick them with her feet. It's me who's getting pulled out, not you. It's my onion, not yours. No sooner did she say it than the onion broke, and the woman fell back into the lake and is burning there to this day. And the angel wept and went away. Now, the temptation, it's the way that this is written, like the temptation is to get formulaic. Once upon a time, she was wicked and she died. There was no good deed. The devil took her. The angel stood thinking, what can I do? Then he remembered and said to God, she gave an onion to the beggar woman. And God said, take the same onion. Okay, so we want to say, oh, there's someone looking out for her. Oh, wow, look how much God loves that even this totally wicked person can be spared, right? Like the temptation is to reduce it, but to do so, I think, is to discard the mystery that is so effective.
I mean, that's what I'm thinking, is that it's not the principial, the precept, thou shalt or thou shalt not. It's seeing this scene in your mind's eye, right? That's the benefit, is that I see the onion. I see the string of people. I see the look on her face as she begins kicking at them, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, and sometimes I am the one.
Right. Well, so,
right. I'm holding on to the onion. So I am kicking at other people.
The personalization of it is when I enter in far enough to become part of every man, right? That I'm identified with that which it means to be human, and this story shows us what it means to be human. Thus, it's me. Right. My students need to constantly be thinking, what would I do? How would I respond? Mm-hmm. Is that me? Is that not me? Is that true to humanity, or is the author making a mistake here? And writers talk about this all the time, that it's almost impossible to set out to write a story about whatever, loneliness or true love or vengefulness or something. If you start out to write about an idea, it's almost always a bad story. The story becomes about that fictional character, if you're going to use the term, this imagined character's life and how they respond to the world in which they live, which is God's world, which has a moral code to it. And if they can't stand the fact that they've been wrongfully imprisoned in this lonely island and all they do is dig a tunnel to get out, and when they finally get out, all they can think of is wreaking their vengeance as the Count of Monte Cristo is consumed by. I don't think he set out to write. Dumas is not trying to write a story to teach us not to be vengeful. He's writing a story about a man whom vengeance consumed and saying, don't be like this man. Is the distinction clear? It's not anti-revenge. It's here's a picture of a man who's consumed by something. We want to learn the lessons.
It's pro-human.
Yeah, we want to learn the lessons without having to go through it ourselves. Really, this is –
Yeah.
This is the notion down the hall in the biology class, you know, we're going in the lab and conducting experiments. But in literature class, the laboratory is the story. It's got living things instead of dead frogs and pigs and whatnot. So it's better. I mean, even though one can contest, well, it's from the imagination of the author to the imagination of the reader, but it's alive.
Well, why is imagination any less alive or any less real or any, because it's less measurable than say, intellect or mathematical computational abilities, right?
It's that scientism that's the product of the Enlightenment. If it can't be proven, quote unquote, scientifically, or if historiography cannot be applied to this, if it's not going to stand up to the tests, the spirit of reduction just eviscerates language class. I talk to students about this all the time who've had other, perhaps more scientifically oriented or more efficient literature teachers, is it was all about dissection. It was all about breaking it down. It was all about reducing it to the moral, or in many cases, even these days, when they don't believe in morals, it's not even worth reducing it to a moral. It's just, how did it make you feel? Well, I am interested in that question, but I want to know why it made you feel that way. And do you think you should follow that feeling, or do you should you run kicking and screaming away from that feeling?
Right. Right. Yeah, that's not a horrible question. It's what you do with that question. That's so important. And yeah, we decided to talk about fiction today, and I think that we're signing ourselves up for some episodes on the Enlightenment, Steve, because we kind of came back to that a couple times. But we teach fiction, and we ought to teach fiction, because education is about the improvement of the soul, and fiction is one way to do that.
Yeah, right. Backwards education.
You can't have your meat if you don't eat your vegetables.